click, 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 click. The film spun to a standstill. There was a thunder of applause, a stamping of feet, and a barrage of empty-banged grain bags. In the very front row of the Odeon, the librarian stared up at the now empty screen. It was the fourth time that afternoon he'd watched Shadow of the Desert, because there's something about a 300-pound orangutan that doesn't encourage people to order it out of the pit between houses. A drift of peanut shells and screwed-up paper bags lay around his feet. The librarian loved the clicks. They spoke to something in his soul. He'd even started writing a story which he thought would make a very good moving picture. It was about a young ape who is abandoned in the big city and grows up being able to speak the language of humans. Everyone he showed it to said it was jolly good, often even before they'd read it. But something about this click was worrying him. He'd sat through it four times, and he was still worried. He eased himself out of the three seats he was occupying and knuckled his way up the aisle and into the little room where Beezam was rewinding the film. Beezam looked up as the door opened.
"Get out," he began, and then grinned desperately and said, "Hello, sir. A pretty good click, eh? We'll be showing it again any minute now, and... What the hell are you do? You can't do that!"
The librarian ripped the huge roll of film off the projector and pulled it through his leathery fingers, holding it up to the light. Beezam tried to snatch it back and got a palm in his chest that sat him firmly on the floor, where great coils of film piled up on top of him. He watched in horror as the great ape grunted, grasped a piece of the film in both hands, and with two bites, edited it. Then the librarian picked him up, dusted him off, patted him on the head, thrust the great pile of unwound click into his helpless arms, and ambled swiftly out of the room with a few frames of film dangling from one paw. Beezam stared helplessly after him.
"You're banned," he shouted,
when he judged the ape to be safely out of earshot. Then he looked down at the two severed ends. Breaks in film weren't unusual. Beezam had spent many a flustered few minutes feverishly cutting and pasting, while the audience cheerfully stamped its feet and high-spiritedly threw peanuts, knives, and double-headed axes at the screen. He let the coils fall around him and reached for the scissors and glue. At least, he found after holding the two ends up to the lantern, the librarian hadn't taken a very interesting bit. Odd, that. Beezam wouldn't have put it past the ape to have taken a bit where the girl was definitely showing too much chest, or one of the fight scenes. But all he'd wanted was a piece that showed the sons galloping down from their mountain fastness, in single file, on identical camels.
"Dunno what he wanted that for," he muttered, taking the lid off the glue pot. "It just shows a lot of rocks."
Victor and Gaspode stood among the sand dunes near the beach.
"That's where the driftwood hut is," said Victor, pointing. "And then if you look hard, you can see there's a sort of road pointing straight towards the hill. But there's nothing on the hill but the old trees."
Gaspode looked back at Holywood Bay.
"Funny it being circular," he said.
"I thought so," said Victor.
"I heard once where there was this city that was so wicked that the gods turned it into a puddle of molten glass," said Gaspode, apropos of nothing. "And the only person who saw it happen was turned into a pillar of salt by day and a cheese shaker by night."
"Gosh, what had the people been doing?"
"Dunno, probably not much. Doesn't take much to annoy gods."
"Me, good boy. Good boy, laddie."
The dog came streaking over the dunes, a comet of gold and orange hair. It skidded to a halt in front of Gaspode, and then began to dance around excitedly, yapping.
"He's escaped, and he wants me to play with him," said Gaspode despondently. "Ridiculous, ain't it? Laddie, drop dead."
Laddie rolled over obediently, all four legs in the air.
"See, he understands every word I say," muttered Gaspode.
"He likes you," said Victor.
"Huh," sniffed Gaspode. "How are dogs ever going to amount to anything if they bounce around worshipping people just because they've been given a meal? What's he want me to do with this?"
Laddie had dropped a stick in front of Gaspode and was looking at him expectantly.
"He wants you to throw it," said Victor.
"What for?"
"So he can bring it back."
"What I don't understand," said Gaspode, as Victor picked up the stick and hurled it away,
Laddie racing along underneath it,
"is how come we've descended from wolves. I mean, your average wolf, he's a bright bugger, know what I mean? Chock full of cunning and like that. We're talking grey paws racing over the trackless tundra is what I'm getting at."
Gaspode looked wistfully at the distant mountains.
And suddenly, a handful of generations later, we've got Percy the Pup here, with a cold nose, bright eyes, glossy coat, and the brains of a stunned herring.
And you, said Victor.
End of side 8. Side 9.
Laddie whirled back in a storm of sand and dropped the damp stick in front of him. Victor picked it up and threw it again. Laddie bounded off, yapping himself sick with excitement.
"Well, yeah," said Gaspard, ambling along in a bow-legged swagger. "Only I can look after myself. It's a dog-eat-dog world out there. You think Dopey the Mutt there would last 5 minutes in Ankh-Morpork? He set one paw in some of the streets. He's 3 sets of fur gloves and crispy fried number 27 at the nearest Clatchy and all-night carry-out."
Victor threw the stick again. "Tell me," he said, "who was the famous Gaspo you're named after?"
"What, you never heard of him?"
"No."
"He was dead famous."
"He was a dog?"
"Yeah. It were years and years ago. There was this old bloke in Ankh who snuffed it, and he belonged to one of them religions where they bury you after you're dead. And they did. And he had this old dog."
"Called Gaspode?"
"Yeah. And this old dog had been his only companion, and after they buried the man, he lay down on his grave and howled for a couple of weeks, growled at everybody who came near, and then died."
Victor paused in the act of throwing the stick again.
"That's very sad," he said.
He threw. Laddie tore along underneath it and disappeared into a stand of scrubby trees on the hillside.
"Yeah. Everyone says it demonstrates a dog's innocent and undying love for his master," said Gaspard, spitting the words out as if they were ashes.
"You don't believe that, then?"
"Not really. I believe any bloody dog will stay still and howl when you've just lowered the gravestone on his tail," said Gaspard.
There was a ferocious barking.
"Don't worry about it. He's probably found a threatening rock or something," said Gaspard.
He'd found Ginger.
The librarian knuckled purposefully through the maze of Unseen University's library and descended the steps towards the maximum security shelves. Nearly all the books in the library were, being magical, considerably more dangerous than ordinary books. Most of them were chained to the bookcases to stop them flapping around. But the lower levels, there they kept the rogue books. The books whose behaviour or mere contents demanded a whole shelf, a whole room to themselves. Cannibal books. Books which, if left on a shelf with their weaker brethren, would be found looking considerably fatter and more smug in the smoking ashes next morning. Books whose mere contents pages could reduce the unprotected mind to grey cheese. Books that were not just books of magic, but magical books. There's a lot of loose thinking about magic. People go around talking about mystic harmonies and cosmic balances and unicorns, all of which is to real magic what a glove puppet is to the Royal Shakespeare Company. Real magic is the hand around the bandsaw, the thrown spark in the powder keg, the dimension warp linking you straight into the heart of a star, the flaming sword that burns all the way down to the pommel. Sooner juggle torches in a tar pit than mess with real magic. Sooner lie down in front of 1,000 elephants. At least, that's what wizards say, which is why they charge such swingingly huge fees for getting involved with the bloody stuff. But down here, in the dark tunnels, there was no hiding behind amulets and starry robes and pointy hats. Down here, you either had it, or you didn't. And if you hadn't got it, you'd had it. There were sounds from behind the heavily barred doors as the librarian shuffled along. Once or twice something heavy threw itself against a door, making the hinges rattle. There were noises. The orangutan stopped in front of an arched doorway that was blocked with a door made not of wood but of stone, balanced so that it could easily be opened from the outside but could withstand massive pressure from within. He paused for a moment and then reached into a little alcove and removed a mask of iron and smoked glass, which he put on, and a pair of heavy leather gloves reinforced with steel mesh. There was also a torch, made of oil-soaked rags. He lit this from one of the flickering braziers in the tunnel. At the back of the alcove was a brass key. He took the key, and then he took a deep breath. All the books of power had their own particular natures. The octavo was harsh and imperious. the Bumper Fun Grimoire went in for deadly practical jokes. The joy of tantric sex had to be kept under iced water. The librarian knew them all, and how to deal with them. This one was different. Usually people saw only 10th or 12th hand copies, as like the real thing as a painting of an explosion was to, well, to an explosion. This was a book that had absorbed the sheer graphite-grey evil of its subject matter. Its name was hacked in letters over the arch, lest men and apes forget. Necrotelecomnicon. He put the key in the lock and offered up a prayer to the gods.
Ook,
he said fervently.
Ook.
The door swung open. In the darkness within, a chain gave a faint clink.
She's still breathing, said Victor.
Laddie leapt around them, barking furiously.
Maybe you should loosen her clothing or something, said Gaspode.
Oh, it's just a thought, he added.
You don't have to glare at me like that. I'm a dog. What do I know?
She seems all right, but look at her hands, said Victor. What the hell's she been trying to do?
Trying to open that door, said Gaspode.
What door?
That door there.
Part of the hill had slipped away. Huge blocks of masonry protruded from the sand. There were the stubs of ancient pillars sticking up like fluoridated teeth. Between two of them was an arched doorway 3 times as high as Victor. It was sealed with a pair of pale grey doors, either of stone or of wood that had become as hard as stone over the years. One of them was slightly open, but had been prevented from opening further by the drifts of sand in front of it. Frantically scrabbled furrows had been dug deep into the sand. Ginger had been trying to shift it with her bare hands.
"Stupid thing to do in this heat," said Victor, vaguely.
He looked from the door to the sea and then down at Gaspode.
Laddie scrambled up the sand and barked excitedly at the crack between the doors.
"What's he doing that for?" said Victor, suddenly feeling spooked. "All his hair is standing up. You don't think he's got one of those mysterious animal premonitions of evil, do you?"
"I think he's a pillock," said Gaspode. "Laddie, shut up!"
There was a yelp. Laddie recoiled from the door, lost his balance on the shifting sand, and rolled down the slope. He leapt to his feet and started barking again, not ordinary stupid dog barking this time, but the genuine treed cat variety. Victor leaned forward and touched the door. It felt very cold, despite the perpetual heat of Holywood, and there was just a faint suspicion of vibration. He ran his fingers over the surface. There was a roughness there, as though there had been a carving that had been worn into obscurity over the years.
"A door like that," said Gaspode behind him. "A door like that, if you want my opinion. A door like that."
He took a deep breath.
"Bodes."
"Hmm? What? Bodes what?"
"It don't have to bode anything," said Gaspode. "Just basic bodingness is bad enough, take it from me."
"It must have been important. Looks a bit temple-ish," said Victor. "Why'd she want to open it?"
"Bits of cliff sliding down and mysterious doors appearing," said Gaspode, shaking his head. "That's a lot of boding. Let's go somewhere far away and really think about it, eh?"
Ginger gave a groan. Victor crouched down.
"What'd she say?"
"Dunno," said Gaspode.
"It sounded like, I want to be alone, I thought."
"Daft. Touch of the sun there, I reckon," said Gaspode, knowledgeably.
"Maybe you're right. Her head certainly feels very hot."
He picked her up, staggering a little under the weight. "Come on," he managed. "Let's get down into the town. It'll be getting dark soon." He looked around at the stunted trees. The door lay in a sort of hollow, which presumably caught enough dew to make the growth there slightly less desiccated than elsewhere.
"You know, this place looks familiar," he said. "We did our first click here. It's where I first met her."
"Very romantic," said Gaspode distantly, hurrying away with Laddie bounding happily around him. "If something horrible comes out of that door, you can think of it as our monster."
"Hey, wait!
Hurry up, then!"
"What would she want to be alone for, do you think?"
"Beats me."
After they'd gone, silence poured back into the hollow. A little later the sun set. Its long light hit the door, turning the merest scratches into deep relief. With the help of imagination, they might just have formed the image of a man with a sword.
There was the faintest of noises as, grain by grain, sand trickled away from the door. By midnight, it had opened by at least a 1/16 of an inch. Holywood dreamed. It dreamed of waking up. Ruby damped down the fires under the vats, put the benches on the tables, and prepared to shut the blue lias. But just before blowing out the last lamp, she hesitated in front of the mirror. He'd been waiting out there again tonight, just like every night. He'd been enduring the evening, grinning to himself. He was planning something. Ruby had been taking advice from some of the girls who worked in the cliques, and in addition to her feather boa, she'd now invested in a broad-rimmed hat with some sort of ugra, cherries she thought they were called, in it. She'd been assured that the effect was stunning. The trouble, she had to admit, was that he was, well, a very hunky troll. For millions of years, troll women had been naturally attracted to trolls built like a monolith with an apple on top. Ruby's treacherous instincts were firing messages up her spine, insidiously insisting that in those long fangs and bandy legs was everything a troll girl could wish for in a mate. Trolls like Rock, or Morrie, of course, were far more modern, and could do things like use a knife and fork. But there was something, well, reassuring about Detritus. Perhaps it was the way his knuckles touched the ground so dynamically. And apart from anything else, she was sure she was brighter than he was. There was a sort of gormless unstoppability about him that she found rather fascinating. That was the instincts at work again. Intelligence has never been a particularly valuable survival trait in a troll. And she had to admit that whatever she might attempt in the way of feather boas and fancy hats, she was pushing 140, and was 400 pounds above the fashionable weight. If only he'd buck his ideas up, or at least buck one idea up. Maybe this makeup the girls had been talking about could be worth a try. She sighed, blew out the lamp, opened the door, and stepped out into a maze of roots. A gigantic tree stretched the whole length of the alley. He must have dragged it for miles. The few surviving branches poked through the windows or waved forlornly in the air. In the middle of it all was Detritus, perched proudly on the trunk, his face split in a watermelon grin, his arms spread wide.
"Thriller!"
he said. Ruby heaved a gigantic sigh. Romance wasn't easy when you were a troll. The librarian forced the page open and chained it down. The book tried to snap at him. Its contents had made it what it was, evil and treacherous. It contained forbidden knowledge. Well, not actually forbidden. No one had ever gone so far as forbidding it. Apart from anything else, in order to forbid it, you'd have to know what it was, which was forbidden. But it definitely contained the sort of information which, once you knew it, you wished you hadn't. The Necrotelecomnicon was written by a Clachian necromancer known to the world as Ahmed the Mad, although he preferred to be called Ahmed the I Just Get These Headaches. It is said that the book was written in one day after Ahmed drank too much of the strange, thick Clachian coffee, which doesn't just sober you up, but takes you through sobriety and out the other side, so that you glimpse the real universe beyond the clouds of warm self-delusion that sapient life usually generates around itself to stop it turning into a nutcake. Little is known about his life prior to this event, because the page headed "About the Author" spontaneously combusted shortly after his death. However, a section headed "Other Books by the Same Author" indicates that his previous published work was Ahmed the I Just Get These Headaches Book of Humorous Cat Stories, which might explain a lot. Legend said that any mortal man who read more than a few lines of the original copy would die insane. This was certainly true. Legend also said that the book contained illustrations that would make a strong man's brain dribble out of his ears. This was probably true, too. Legend went on to say that merely opening the Necrotelecomnicon would cause a man's flesh to crawl off his hand and up his arm. No one actually knew if this was true, but it sounded horrible enough to be true, and no one was about to try any experiments. Legend had a lot to say about the Necrotelecomnicon, in fact, but absolutely nothing to say about orangutans, who could tear the book into little bits and chew it, for all Legend cared. The worst that had ever happened to the librarian after looking at it was a mild migraine and a touch of eczema. but that was no reason to take chances. He adjusted the smoked glass of the visor and ran one black leather finger down the index. The words bridled as the digit slid past and tried to bite it. Occasionally he'd hold the strip of film up to the light of the flickering torch. The wind and sand had blurred them, but there was no doubt that there were carvings on the rock, and the librarian had seen designs like that before. He found the reference he was looking for, and after a brief struggle, during which he had to threaten the Necrotelecomnicon with the torch, forced the book to turn the page. He peered closer. Good old Ahmed the I just get these headaches. And in that hill, it is said, a door out of the world was found, and people of the city watched what was seen therein, knowing not that dread waited between the universes. The librarian's fingertip dragged from right to left across the pictures and skipped to the next paragraph. For others found the gate of holy wood, and fell upon the world, and in 190 all manner of madnessy befell, and chaos prevailed, and the city sank beneath the sea, and all became one with the fishes and the lobsters, save for the few who fled. He curled a lip and looked further down the page. A golden warrior who drove the fiends back and saved the world and said, Where the gate is, there am I also. I am he that was born of holy wood, to guard the wild idea. And they said, What must we do to destroy the gate for ever? And he said unto them, This you cannot do, for it is not a thing. But I will guard the gate for you. And they, not having been born yesterday, and fearing the cure more than the malady, said to him, What will you take from us that you will guard the door? And he grew until he was the height of a tree, and said, Only your remembrance, that I do not sleep. 3 times a day will you remember, Holywood. Else the cities of the world will tremble and fall, and you will see the greatest of them all in flames. And with that the golden man took up his golden sword, and went into the hill, and stood at the gate forever. And the people said to one another, Funny, he looks just like my Uncle Osbert. The librarian turned the page. But there were among them humans and animals alike, those touched by the magic of Holywood. It goeth through the generations like an ancient curse, until the priests cease in their remembrance, and the golden man sleepeth. Then let the world beware. The librarian let the book snap shut. It wasn't an uncommon legend. He'd read it before, at least had read most of it, in books considerably less dangerous than this. You came across variants in all the cities of the Stow Plain. There had been a city once in the mists of prehistory, bigger than Ankh-Morpork, if that were possible, and the inhabitants had done something, some sort of unspeakable crime, not just against mankind or the gods, but against the very nature of the universe itself, which had been so dreadful that it had sunk beneath the sea one stormy night. Only a few people had survived to carry to the barbarian peoples in the less advanced parts of the disk all the arts and crafts of civilization, such as usury and macrame. No one had ever really taken it seriously. It was just one of those usual, if you don't stop it, you'll go blind myths that civilizations tend to hand on to their descendants. After all, Ankh-Morpork itself was generally considered as wicked a city as you could hope to find in a year of shore leaves, and seemed to have avoided any kind of supernatural vengeance, although it was always possible that it had taken place and no one had noticed. Legend had always put the nameless city far away and long ago. No one knew where it was, or even if it had existed. The librarian glared at the symbols again. They were very familiar. They were on the old ruins all over Holywood. Azrael stood on a low hill, watching the sea of elephants move below him. Here and there a supply wagon bobbed between the dusty grey bodies like a rudderless boat. A mile of veldt was being churned into a soggy mud wallow, bare of grass, although by the smell of it, it'd be the greenest patch on the disk after the rains came. He dabbed at his eyes with the corner of his robe. 363. Who'd have thought it? The air was solid with the peaked trumpeting of 363 elephants. And with the hunting and trapping parties already going on ahead, there should be plenty more. According to Mbu, anyway. And he wasn't going to argue. Funny that. For years he'd thought of Mbu as a sort of mobile smile, a handy lad with a brush and a shovel, but not what you might call a major achiever. And then suddenly, someone somewhere wanted 1,000 elephants, and the lad had raised his head and a gleam had come into his eye, and you could see that under that grin was a skilled chylopachydermatalist, ready to answer the call. Funny, you could know someone for their whole life and not realize that the gods had put them into this world to move 1,000 elephants around the place. Azrael had no sons. He'd already made up his mind to leave everything to his assistant. Everything he had at this point amounted to 363 elephants and a ha-ha-ha, a mammoth overdraft. But it was the thought that counted. Mbu trotted up the path towards him, his clipboard held firmly under one arm.
"Everything ready, boss," he said. "You just got to say the word."
Azrael drew himself up. He looked around at the heaving plain, the distant baobab trees, the purple mountains. Oh yes, the mountains. He'd had misgivings about the mountains. He'd mentioned them to Mbu, who'd said, "We'll cross them bridges when we get to 'em, boss." And when Azrael had pointed out that there weren't any bridges, he had looked him squarely in the eye and said firmly, "First, we build them bridges, then we cross 'em."